I Eat Green with Bhavani, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Bhavani, and you're listening to I Eat Green with Bhavani. You can catch me every Wednesday from 5 to 6 on the Progressive Radio Network. And every week I will share with you some recipes and introduce you to someone out in our community that's really making change. And this week I'm really excited to introduce my guest. Her name is Anita Eisenhower. And she is a chef and an associate professor up at the Culinary Arts Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. And I first met Anita a few months ago when we were in Torino, Italy at the Slow Food Conference called Terra Madre. And it was an unbelievable experience, as I know many of you have heard me talk about before. And I just had a great time. And I met her in our breakout session where I got to meet lots of U.S. delegates, and we were in a little group together, and I got to speaking with her, and I was really impressed with her background and what she's done, and I was also very curious as to how the Culinary Institute of America is addressing sustainability at this time in our world, and whether or not they were addressing any of the issues that I'm so passionate about. And so I asked Anita to come on to answer some of these questions with us. So, Anita, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Anita. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Great. So thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome.
And sharing with me some, you know, an answer to some of these longing questions that I have about the CIA and how they are addressing sustainability, you know, this day and age when it's so prevalent for so many of us. And I know you are concerned about that just because you were at Terra Madre. And if you weren't concerned about that, I wouldn't have had the privilege of meeting you there. So why don't we just generally start by you telling me, tell everybody a little bit more about you and your background, because I have a whole bio here that I didn't really go into. Share with them what your experience is, and then tell us a little bit about the CIA and how they are addressing sustainability in this day and age.
Sure. Well, what struck me about your intro is that our visit to Terra Madre was just very, very recent, and it seems like the problems and the issues that we learned about and that we continue to face together as a community are critical at this point in our history. But the truth is that these issues have been important to develop and to face for many, many years. So the CIA has been around since 1946, and I feel like a lot of the issues that we talked about and that we talked about at Terra Madre and that we talk about it within our community here are very old issues, and the challenge is really how to address the issues in a continually changing society, in a continually more complex quality to these issues. So we've been working on them for a really long time, and so have I. I've been here for 8 years. And one of the reasons I came here was because I thought I could really dive into some of these issues and also be part of teaching the next generation about these issues, more importantly, how to act on these issues. And so 15 years ago, I started in New York City my cooking career and worked for a restaurateur named Peter Hoffman. And Peter Hoffman was one of the originating members of Chefs Collaborative. And
oh, really?
Of course, he was one of the first chefs in New York City to really put his arms around the concepts that are so important today. And so,
and what is his name? Peter what?
Peter Hoffman.
Hoffman, okay.
He was, he has a restaurant named Savoy.
I know that restaurant, uh-huh.
And, you know, 15, 20 years ago, he was putting these practices, sustainability practices, into his restaurant, and he was a living example of how successful a restaurant can be while still practicing the best practices of sustainability.
Right.
And he really introduced the community in New York City, the community of restaurants in New York City, to the not only the farmers markets of New York City, but also to inviting farmers that are farmers from Hudson Valley and farmers from a locality or a local area to come into the city and be part of his whole operation. He did that by having special dinners in which the farmers could come and talk to us, not only the cooks and not only the cooking community, but other customers, regular customers, about what he was doing and what they were doing and what needed to happen in the future. So he was really a mover and a shaker in that way early in my career, and helped me to shape some of my ideas about spreading the word and the importance of educating a greater community than your cooks about how to move forward.
Right. Well, that's great, because I know, you know, when I go to a restaurant and I want to order fish and my only choice is, you know, red snapper or, you know, farm-raised salmon, you know, I have a real dilemma, because I do eat fish. You know, I mostly eat vegetarian, but when I'm out, that's kind of when I eat fish, because it just makes it so much easier. And when my fish choices are fish that I'm boycotting because they're not sustainable, you know, it's a real dilemma. And, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if, you know, people got to a restaurant and, you know, they asked for red snapper and the waiter said, I'm sorry, we're not serving red snapper, you know, right now until it, you know, becomes more sustainable or is, you know, no longer threatened fish.
Right, like swordfish. One of the best results of technology today and of the greater awareness, really just such a greater awareness of all of these issues, is that there's a lot more opportunity and willingness on the part of both customers and chefs to open up that conversation. So if you are that customer sitting in that restaurant and wondering why the decisions have been made in the way that they've been made, it's a good idea to try to inquire now. And it's not only a good idea, but it's also for the customer, but it's, I think the chefs are more willing to involve themselves in that type of conversation. So so I'm hoping that's one of the results of especially we here at the CIA and a number of other great culinary institutes. One of the results is that we are asking our young people to learn about these subjects and to be a part of the conversation and to be more involved with their customers in the conversation. So I hope that's a result of technology, of being more informed, and of the work that we do here every day.
Right. Now, how many? I know you mentioned Peter Hoffman was one of the founders of Chefs Collaborative. Is that right?
One of the founding members. Yes.
Yeah. You know, because that's been a very informative organization for me in my career. I know if I'm not sure about something, I know I can refer to the Chefs Collaborative website, which I'm a member of, and, you know, and they help me out, certainly, you know, with the sustainable fish issue. So how many, you know, is the CIA now, with your influence, you know, teaching more to that? Do they have classes on sustainable food selection and that kind of thing?
We do. There is so much that we do here. We have now four campuses. And there's a long list of things that we do to educate our students, to educate our students and educate ourselves, educate our community. But particularly with classes designed for students, for our student population, we have a fish fabrication class to begin with, where these issues are talked about. Not only do they learn how to handle fish and how to recognize fish and how to fabricate fish or break it down, but they also learn about some of the contemporary issues about fishing, limitations, about advisements and and populations of different areas of the world, like the tuna problem right now in the Mediterranean and the Gulf of Mexico. So it's all, those are, because they're very contemporary issues, and they're issues that our students are going to face as chefs and even as cooks. It's our obligation and our, you know, it's our obligation to talk about these contemporary issues. We also have a number of clubs where a student can express a greater interest or a deeper interest in some of these issues and learn more about them. So the clubs are an active source of information for them in a deeper way than those initial beginning classes are. And the clubs are extracurricular. Students can spend a lot of time in a very focused area learning about it, and also taking trips or going to conferences or being connected in certain ways. We live so close to New York City, we often introduce our students to chefs who are important in these areas, who might be in the city. We invite speakers through the clubs. We invite speakers to come and speak to our students about these issues. So Chefs Collaborative is, we have a club on campus called the Chefs Sustaining Agriculture. It's a club that's dedicated to finding out and educating ourselves and being active about issues within sustainability. And Chefs Collaborative, the club is kind of a mix between the mission of Slow Food and the mission of Chefs Collaborative.
Mm.
Chefs Collaborative being uniquely American. So,
too bad that can't be a required class.
Well, it's not a required class, but we. We don't want to require students to go further than they want to go into these subject matters. But the trick or the magic to teaching, I suppose, is to invite them in such a way that they're stepping into that arena voluntarily and with excitement. So,
mm-hmm.
So
what do you find? What population of your student body actually gets involved in that club?
It's one of the largest and most active clubs on campus. We have, we have a population of about 2,300
wow.
students a year.
Uh-huh.
It's a large population. We have lots of clubs. So what we find is that students have a number of different interests, but we see, maybe 100 or 200 students can come in and out of the club for different events. They're never required to attend every event, but really, during the course of a year, I have individual interaction with about 300 students, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And so the number of students who pass through the club and who actively take part in the club in different parts of their education, I would say, is in the hundreds.
Mm-hmm. And what classes do you teach up at the CIA?
I currently teach Cuisines of the Mediterranean. I've taught Cuisines of the Americas. I taught for 4 years in one of our core restaurants, the American Bounty.
Mm-hmm.
The American Bounty was one of those classes in which you had asked me a question earlier about the mission of Slow Food.
Mm-hmm.
Do we adhere to, or do we honor some of the important points in Slow Food? And I would say that American Bounty is one of those classes in which we teach specifically about how to include American foodways, traditional foodways, and products into your regular menu,
mm-hmm.
especially in areas of preservation, and it's a very open book as to what we can talk about. So contemporary issues as they come up. One contemporary issue right now is a very important issue: school lunch. So we may focus a little more attention on that particular subject within the umbrella of sustainability,
mm-hmm.
During a few classes and pay a little more attention to the child nutrition bill that was up just last month.
Right.
So the American Bounty restaurant is a great mix between historical learning and contemporary practice and
mm-hmm.
Contemporary discussion on issues. So I taught that for a number of years, and then I've taught other classes. We all teach skills classes, basic skills classes, breakfast, lunch, cookery, and we continue to develop into other areas. Mm-hmm. Asian cuisine, for instance, will be my next area of study.
Which one?
Asian cuisine.
Ah, I love it.
Yeah.
And now when you were in the American Bounty, when you were addressing the school lunch, do you just talk about, is it more talking about the issues regarding, you know, the way the school lunch program is set up with, you know, some meals getting free, or is it more talking about the nutritional quality of the meals? Do you get into any of the advocacy work trying to mobilize students towards, you know, calling their senators or congressmen when it was coming time to vote? You know, like, what aspect of the school lunch program would you look at with your students, for instance?
Well, we would, the issues with school lunch right now are issues that would be looked at in a new restaurant. We started a new restaurant concept, which is a sustainable restaurant concept. And that restaurant is called St. Andrews.
Yes, I was looking at that one. Uh-huh.
Right. So this issue would now is now talked about as part of the curriculum, a part of the core curriculum of that restaurant, which is really fantastic. We're very, very happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
Within that curriculum, I think one way that discussion is started is to really introduce what's going on right now, which is the money of the problem, which
mm-hmm.
is one way that for instance last year one way that the issue was introduced was by inviting speakers, in this case Ann Cooper, in to speak about the issues involved. And it's a complicated school lunch is a complicated issue. And so how do you introduce it to students? You try to cover many of the bases.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the legislation, talk about the quality of the food, you talk about the cooks and the lunch, the people who are preparing the food, you talk about the students who are choosing the food, you talk about
the equipment, the lack of equipment.
The equipment, you talk
right.
about the nutritional values. It's so multifaceted that really one of the greatest things we can do is we can invite those speakers in who are experts in that particular field to teach us and to teach our students the deeper meaning of these issues and the deeper details of the issues.
Right, and like you said, just having the conversation, starting the conversation.
That's right, and networking those students who are part of that discussion can become part of a network. They can communicate directly with that person, with that speaker,
mm-hmm.
as they move along in their career. And so very often, just beginning the conversation, it enlightens a student enough to make them aware of their further interest, and then they can go further into it, whether it be in the clubs or even directly into the issue with that expert that we've brought in.
Mm-hmm.
So there are such a number of ways to address these issues, both within the curriculum, within the clubs, within networking, that we can introduce students to those speakers that are so important, who visit us and who help to educate a great number of students
mm-hmm.
On these issues. We're just very lucky and blessed that we have access to the information, to the experts, and also to a lot of discussion.
Right. Right. As far as with the school lunch programs, have any of your chefs or students participated in the Chef's Move to School? Are you familiar with that program?
Yes, I am. We are becoming more involved from a different couple of different angles. One of our graduates, well, Ann Cooper is a graduate. She's definitely leading the way.
Mm-hmm.
Another of our graduates, Andrea Martin, is very, very involved in another direction with schools,
mm-hmm.
school lunches.
Yeah, but for those of you listening who don't know, Chefs Move to Schools is an initiative set out by Michelle Obama to try to bring professional chefs into schools to try to, you know, as Anita said, approach it from many different angles, whether it's to infuse the meal plan with some new exciting recipes, or whether to train the kitchen staff people a little bit, whether to talk about nutrition with the students or the PTA. I mean, there's so many different areas that chefs move to schools can do. However, the thing is, there's no funding for it. It's completely a volunteer situation. And I know just because I have volunteered for the chefs move to schools, and I've had many schools call me, and, you know, there's only so much available volunteer time. And these problems are so big that even with a full-time person, you can barely make a dent or a change into the school lunch program. So it's really a challenge.
I think the message is, and I think it's really important to focus on the main message of that whole movement. And I think the main message is that if you can do anything, that each person can make a dent. And if 1,000 people or 1,000,000 people do one thing to make a dent in this issue, then that's going to be a lot of dents, and it's going to be a huge dent, and it's going to help to move us in the right direction to begin to fix some problems.
It's so true, and I call out to my listeners and to people all the time to, you know, for everyone to do something. It's so easy to kind of sit back and just be critical, because there's so many things to be critical about.
Well, not only to be critical and to have some, you know, to bring some, try to bring some objective critical analysis to it, but also to advocate in a positive way, to ask for change, and then to work to involve yourself for that change.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough to ask for change and then not be willing to work toward change with the people who need to make change. So participation is as important as the critique. And so in a number of ways the CIA is participating. We have a research project going on. And I wanted to say one of the greatest values of volunteerism and of participation in finding out what the solutions are is that there's more information that we get from that. So if five different people participate in five different solutions, then all of those solutions can be compared and contrasted, and eventually the information can be consolidated, and perhaps one or two solutions are move forward.
Mm-hmm.
So gathering the information is really important. That's what we're doing as volunteers in the chefs move to school. There's one community here who participated in the chef's move to school. They had a recent contest, a recipe contest,
mm-hmm.
Whose deadline was just in December. So we had a very excited group of people who paired up with one of our local schools, and they came up with several recipes. They went through the program. They tested the recipes in the school. And the students got to choose their favorite recipes, and now those recipes are submitted for evaluation to the Chef's Let's Move program. So that's one way in which we do it. Another direction that we're working on here at the CIA is that there's one of our clubs on campus, the club that I advise, called Chefs in Community Service, has been asked and is supported by a local school district to go in and start to teach fifth graders start to give demos to fifth graders, and we're pairing up with the chef who is, for instance, introducing new dishes like couscous to the students on one day. So before he introduces couscous to the students, he wants us to come in and give a demonstration and teach the students what couscous is.
Mm-hmm.
They realize that if the students are at least familiar to the product before they served it, they would be more open to trying it. So we're working cooperatively with that school district to try to make that happen.
Right.
And then we also have a funded research project that is taking a look at a number of school districts in our area, and focusing our energy and our expertise on on the back of the house, on what's going on with the system systematically that can make the introduction of better food easier.
So what's the research project actually?
The research project is through one of our health and wellness initiatives, and the research project has actually been going on for a few years. It's a cooperatively done with the New York City school system, and we studied the New York City number of schools in the New York City school system, studied their system, and studied some of their problems or their issues, and brought that information back and discussed it roundtable style on a number of occasions, and decided to shape some ideas, some strategies, and are going to take those ideas and strategies into a number of local schools in the Hudson Valley, and work with our local schools to see if we can make an impact, a positive impact, on their system. And then along the way, we're going to track all of the information. And I think the important part of this project is that we're really tracking the information for one of the first times. So, our projects with students, with my students, with our club, is that we're not tracking all the information. We're participating in a very fun and great way. Whereas the research project is a matter of really setting up strategies, tracking the information, evaluating the information, and then moving forward from there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Are you guys familiar with the New York Coalition for Healthy School Food?
Yes, familiar with it, yeah.
Yeah, because I know they've been working with New York City public schools as well, trying to introduce some more plant-based foods into the schools and also some more ethnic foods to, you know, diverse populations, because, you know, we have such a mixture of diversity in our schools, and the menu selection usually doesn't reflect that.
That's definitely, I know that's a direction that they're looking into or accommodating on many levels, is how to bring students who have very strong ethnic backgrounds and very strong ethnic foods better into the system, and how to invite them via their own flavors and flavor profiles into the pleasure of eating
right.
School lunches. So, and I know that vegetarianism in particular is a major area of your interest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a vegetable-based diet or a meat, a vegetable-centric diet is such a good direction to go in.
For so many levels.
On so many levels. Really,
so many health. Levels for, you know,
health and wellness
planet.
Of Earth, health and wellness of
right.
of human beings, and really, in my opinion, to offer a greater variety and balance in general.
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of articles, you know, in the New York Times, especially, you know, just really focusing on more vegetarian foods and, you know, people that, what do they call them? People that swing both ways, you know, they're not...
People that swing both ways.
You know, they're not vegetarians, but they're very happy to eat meals that do not contain meat. And as...
I call them normal people.
Normal people.
I call them having a good balance of taste and flavor and health.
Right, but there are many people that just feel like a meal's not complete if they don't have meat as part of it. And that's, you know, where, as a person who's really trying to go more of the middle of the road, even though my preference is more towards vegetarian, in trying to reach a wider audience, I'm really trying to just encourage people to cut down on the meat that they eat.
Yeah.
And if you are going to eat meat, then to put that extra money into purchasing meat that's raised sustainably.
Right.
So, you know, that's kind of the position that I've evolved to in my own life when, you know, trying to encourage people to become more sustainable. Because I know, you know, most people are not going to.
Well, I think that the things that you've just mentioned are a completely reasonable expectation. I think it's a completely reasonable and achievable goal. You're accommodating. Frankly, I grew up in the Midwest, and I just love meat,
mm-hmm.
and I don't eat it for every meal of every day. I eat it a lot less than a proper Midwesterner usually
uh-huh.
probably does. But the sensibility of balancing your diet, particularly with the issues that we face today, is critical, and so whether you know it's so ingrained in our history to eat meat every meal that at some point we have to balance all of our histories with our nutritional needs, with our the needs of our earth and the needs of the sustainability or the survivability of our food system.
Right.
So we have to apply some critical analysis to all of those pieces and move forward in our behavior. So it's a great big puzzle, and I feel like people are more open today to hearing that than ever before. And though there's still a lot of work ahead, really a ton of work ahead to help people transition into understanding that not just the desire for balance, but the desperate need for balance in those areas is part of our charge here as chefs.
Yeah, and it's everyone's responsibility, really, to start making those sacrifices. I mean, you know, for someone who really loves meat, it is a sacrifice, I understand, to transition into eating a more plant-based diet, but it's a responsibility issue, you know, for the well-being of the planet.
And I think also a thing that doesn't often get talked about is the quality of each meal. So one of the things that we try to do, and that I try to do with our students, is to help to balance that scale by talking about how special each meal can become by increasing the quality of it. And so if I'm asking someone or introducing the idea of cutting down from 5 meals of meat to 2 meals of meat, part of the way in which I help that happen is that I make those 2 meals that include meat very, very special meals.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I can increase the quality of cooking, the specialness of each and every meal, then I can I'm more likely to be able to transition that person into less often but more special
mm-hmm.
type of thinking.
Right. Another way I've heard many people trying to do it is to put a little bit of meat into something for flavor, but not actually eat, you know, a big chunk of meat, so that they might put, you know, some meat into a soup so that it has that resonance, but it's not, you know, it's not really filled with a lot of meat. I guess that's the idea with people putting bones into soups and things like that.
I mean, I feel like that's a really sophisticated way to look at the dimension in food, the dimension in flavor. It's a really important way to include flavor. It's a full use of the animal, which is something we could do more of
mm-hmm.
in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a really smart way to go. You're right. It's a way to enjoy the flavor of meat without actually eating the full steak or the full piece of meat.
Right. And then the other side is to also help people learn how to cook vegetables in a more flavorful, full meal way. I mean, so many people who feel like they don't like vegetables, I believe, never really were given delicious, tasty vegetables to eat. Because if they were, I just can't believe that they wouldn't like them because they're so good. You know, one here or there, they, you know, might not be someone's favorite. But yeah. In general, so often the energy when people are cooking, they put it all towards the meat or the protein. And the vegetable is just, you know, such a side thought. You know, like, okay, let's quickly open up a can of vegetables or you know, throw this pouch into some boiling water and voila, you have your vegetables. And they don't really think about putting that time and energy into looking up recipes that might excite them, that, you know, I mean, with the internet now, you can find a recipe for anything at your fingertips.
Right.
And it's so easy to make, you know, vegetables delicious. I know, you know, some of the restaurants are going like Meatless Mondays or...
Yeah.
Is the CIA talking about that with their students at all, of trying to, you know, do they have classes that are just on, you know, cooking vegetables? Because I know they have classes that are just on, you know, butchering a cow or something like that. Do they have classes that are focused on just making vegetables delicious?
Well, we focus on that in every class, really. I mean, we use a lot of vegetables. We use vegetables in every class. In every class, we have a vegetarian option offered at
mm-hmm.
every meal, every class. And we do not have a vegetarian class per se, but we talk about how to make delicious vegetables, for particularly in our global area,
mm-hmm.
in our globals classes. There are a couple of research projects going on right now that one of our chefs is involved in, Chef Shirley Chang, who's brilliant, and these research projects are the science of flavor, the importance of dimension in food, and how certain elements bring dimension to food. For instance, where she's studying tamarind right now, and how tamarind can elevate the dimension of a food, any food, but also vegetables, any
mm-hmm.
food, to the level that we can reduce the salt, the amount of sodium in that food. So we talk about vegetables not only as they land on the plate and visible and whole vegetables, but also vegetables as a component of umami, of adding dimension to other dishes, to all dishes.
Mm-hmm.
She's also doing a study on Sichuan peppercorns and just the great dimension of flavors that come from the different areas that Sichuan raises their peppercorns in. So, we do talk about vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
We make vegetables. We talk about vegetarianism. We have a nutrition class that studies different alternate diets, different diets. We have our globals classes, which focus on particularly in the Mediterranean, the fact that many of the foods of the Mediterranean are not meat-based or meat-priority meals. And so we do a lot of work with vegetables. I think that we need to do more. Even with all of that, we need to do more.
Mm-hmm.
But I would, having a Meatless Monday here would be a dream. It's very difficult for our system. But we had a serious discussion about the need for even more in the area of vegetable consumption
mm-hmm.
for our students and for their greater learning and also their greater weight issues.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in development with a couple of ideas in that direction. So it's very, very important, very
yeah.
important subject.
It really is, because also, I mean, I, as a vegetarian, I know even going out to vegetarian restaurants, so very often I'm disappointed. Or if I order, you know, sauteed broccoli rabe at an Italian restaurant and it comes and I take one bite and I taste chicken broth,
mm.
you know, and to steam, you know, so that they don't have to use so much oil, they choose to put in a broth, but they put in chicken broth, not thinking that someone ordering just broccoli rabe might be interested in just the vegetable. You know, and I have to return it. Or I remember, you know, ordering out for Mother's Day, went to a very special restaurant, and I got a fish, and it had a sauce on it that I couldn't place the flavor. And turns out it was like a veal reduction sauce on top of my fish.
Uh-oh.
You know,
yeah.
And then somebody else had a poached fish, and it was poached in duck fat, you know, which I guess is a traditional French way of doing it. But it's,
yeah.
you know, it's...
Which would be delicious, unless which to me sounds delicious, but it's not what you ordered. So that's
it's not what your
perception was of what you ordered. So
right, and also for so many people when they go out to eat, I mean, not so many people, but there are people that also choose fish for kosher dietary reasons.
Right.
You know, and you think that you're getting fish and that's okay to eat out. And so, you know, I'm trying to, you know, educate my listeners to knowing that you really have to ask about everything. I mean, just sauteed broccoli rabe is not necessarily just a, you know, broccoli rabe, and fish is not necessarily just fish. You know, you just, you know, there's so many ways that chefs traditionally have been taught how to hide meat into something that doesn't necessarily need to have it.
Well, that's, you know, it's not, I would characterize the word, the process differently, and I would characterize it in a such a way that cooking broccoli rabe with chicken stock is one interesting, you know, one very smart way to introduce the flavor of meat, just like you were talking about before,
right.
You know, using stocks or using bones to up the flavor of something. It's, you know, cooking fish in fat is a great, those are in meat fat, is that's a great combination of flavors. So I would agree with you that I think it's in a customer's best interest to ask questions and to find out how something is prepared. It also goes to the statement that I made earlier about how integrated vegetables are to all of our courses. Vegetables are as important as anything else on the plate, as the grains or the beans or the meat, and so to have some crossover or some integration of all of those flavors together in a single meal is not unheard of, and it's actually a very smart way to go.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the contemporary subject of dealing with particular diets and needing to operate differently for those particular diets. So in the end, it's just a great idea to get to know your local restaurant, your local restaurateur.
Right, to ask the questions, how it's prepared.
And if you have a preference, if something doesn't work out for you, to know your local restaurateur and to initiate the conversation.
Right.
And it's my hope and it's my assumption that the restaurateur is in the business of hospitality and will accommodate that conversation and accommodate anyone's needs or necessities in terms of the diet.
Right, right. Yeah, they should.
It's not always easy,
that,
right? You don't always get the opportunity to eat locally or to have that conversation on a busy Saturday night in the middle of a service, but as often as possible, that's a great idea.
Right, right. You know, that's why I guess I know that I end up so often choosing to cook at home, because it's hard to go out and to know that you're going to get the quality ingredients. You know, certainly in the city, in downtown New York, there's more selection of restaurant choices where you know the quality. But,
you know what,
if you're trying to avoid, you know, GMO vegetables and, you know, meats that have antibiotics or hormones, most places don't do that.
Right. It's a much deeper subject, and it's you know, that people are becoming more educated on. Hopefully, the generation that we're educating on these things are moving into those restaurants. So it's not unheard of. Absolutely.
Right.
You know what I find a good solution also is just to email the restaurant. You know, if you know you're going somewhere, if you have the opportunity to begin the conversation before you arrive at the restaurant, then that's it's a sensible and great way for both parties to find out what exactly is going on in terms of buying and preparation of any of the inventory of food.
Mm-hmm. Right. Does the CIA take a stance on, you know, genetically modified you know, vegetables or cloned animals, or, you know, what's their take on, you know, the manipulation of science with nature?
I have not asked specifically about cloned. The cloned animals hasn't really been on the forefront of our discussion, so I can't answer for that.
Because I've heard, I mean, I don't know for a fact, but I've heard that that's really starting to, it's already starting to hit the market, and they don't have to label it as cloned. Is that true, or do you not know?
I had read a piece that had said that it was not going to be required labeling.
Right.
But within the same piece, I had read that that the process was far too expensive to expect any integration to the regular food system just yet. But it's a good subject and important to at least begin to look into if it hasn't been already.
Mm-hmm.
But on the subject of GMO, where we are, it's a controversial. There are a number of different communities here at the CIA that feel differently about it. It's a hot topic of discussion,
mm-hmm.
In the opinion of the CIA, thus far is to allow the faculty and allow the community members of the CIA to further flesh it out and make decisions as groups as to how to move forward on that.
So have they fleshed any of that out and made any decisions?
In terms of
still in the process.
I think it's still in the process. I think to be honest, there are a number of people at the CIA who would like to see the CIA take a stand on that. And to be honest, we're still in the process.
Mm-hmm.
That.
Right.
So,
yes, it's you know. For me, coming from where I am, it's not such a tricky subject. To me, it's just, because I'm also looking at the health of the planet in addition to the quality of the vegetables, for me, it feels like a no-brainer, because the spraying and the manipulating of the seeds, it's not good for the soil. It's not good for the health of people. I mean, they've definitely done testing of the quality of the vitamins that are in, genetically modified vegetables, and they're not of the same quality as vegetables before. However, in defense of some other vegetables, I know they've also tested organic vegetables that are not in the same quality as vegetables of 30 years ago. The soil's becoming more depleted. I'm actually taking a class right now on nutrient-dense crop production, of how to build up the vitality in the soil so that you can have the healthiest vegetables possible. And that, the condition of the soil and what the soil's eating is equally important, because that's what goes into the vegetable. So
we just purchased another a small property where we're developing it now for CIA garden here in the Hyde Park campus.
And will they do them organically?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yes. We're consulting with a local farmer, an organic farmer who also has his CSA, Farmer Gunther. And he...
Oh, I know him.
Dan Gunther, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And
at the Pfeiffer Center, right?
Pardon me?
At the Pfeiffer Center?
No, well, he's in New Paltz. He has his farm in New Paltz.
Okay, uh-huh.
And he's coming, and he's helped us evaluate the land. He's helped us evaluate the soil. He's going to draw a plan of what to plant, where to plant, when to plant.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to really help us begin to build that area of our curriculum. It'll be part of our curriculum, part of our St. Andrews class.
Oh, that's great. I'm so happy to hear that. That's really, because I think it's so important for chefs, just like anybody else. I think it's really important for us all to know where our vegetables come from and how they're grown.
And the issues that you've raised about organic versus inorganic, GMOs versus the use of any
conventional,
GMOs versus old ways of farming and new ways of farming and without the use of chemicals. These are all subjects that we need to attend to in the curriculum,
mm-hmm.
and invite students to really talk about these issues, introduce them to a lot of different sources of information, and help them their opinions take shape, in many different directions. Actually,
uh-huh.
We can't. I'm not in education to drive the result of a student's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Education is about introducing the information in such a way that it's true information as much as we know it to be. It's complete information with as many sources as we can provide, and that we help students critically analyze it to a degree that they can make their own decision in the end of
mm-hmm.
all of that. So that is our stance right now, is gathering information, introducing the information, practicing some good practices.
Mm-hmm.
We don't plan on planting any GMO products in that garden. So there are a lot of good things going on here at the CIA in the areas of organic, in the area of sustainability, and in the area of just best practices
mm-hmm.
for the earth.
That's great. I'm thrilled to hear that. I just have another question. In the St. Andrews Cafe, which I know is, based on more sustainable practices, do they have, because I was looking at the menu when I was looking. First, one, is it open at night time or is it only lunch up there? Do they have a dinner menu?
We're gonna open for dinner soon. Two of our restaurants have one meal off, or one. We have an AM and a PM class, so
mm-hmm.
each restaurant has two classes. And so two of our restaurants right now are offline for one of their meal periods with some altering of class sizes and such.
Mm-hmm.
But they will very soon be open for dinner and lunch.
Oh, good. And then...
are you going to come up?
I'm hoping to, but that's the restaurant I wanted to go to, and I was looking to see if you had dinner. But also, for vegetarian entrees, do you... teach students about cooking tofu? I know you just mentioned you had an Asian chef there, so I'm sure she cooks tofu. But do you get into teaching chefs about cooking tofu or seitan or tempeh,
of
the pillars of vegetarian proteins?
All of those ingredients are used in our Asians cooking class.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah. And, and then the restaurants... So the regular program and the global cuisines that I mentioned, by and large stay with traditional dishes from those countries.
Mm-hmm.
It is in the restaurants that we can depart according to the chef, can depart from traditional dishes and move into contemporary dishes.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an Italian restaurant. We have the American restaurant. We have St. Andrews now, which is a sustainable restaurant, and we have the Apple Pie Cafe. We have Escoffier, which is a traditional French restaurant
right now. Right, but within the courses, you really follow the ethnicity of the culture.
We always follow the ethnicity, but whatever contemporary influences come in, we do that. And the restaurants all offer vegetarian options, which are dishes in and of themselves. They're not, when someone orders a vegetarian dish, we're not pulling together all the sides and pulling together all the side vegetables and putting it on a plate and sending it out.
Right.
They have their independent vegetarian entrees.
Wonderful.
Yeah, which is a standard of operation.
Well, I certainly will get in touch when I do get up there.
Please do.
And you do the same when you're down this way. And if you listen in, I'm going to share my recipe for a really hearty miso soup, a vegetarian alternative to chicken soup during this flu season. So I want to thank you, Anita, so much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you for having
and,
me.
And I am going to talk about my recipe now, okay?
Okay, have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
Bye.
Bye. Hi, everybody. Real quick, before they kick me off the air, I just want to share with you a great miso soup recipe. Miso soup, you know, as I just mentioned, is like a vegetarian chicken soup. It's really great this time of year when people have flus and they're feeling under the weather. Miso soup is just great for building up your immune system. So you want to start with sautéing an onion and a carrot in some in a little bit of olive oil with some celery. Then you also want to wash a burdock root or two and chop that up really fine and put that in and sauté that a little bit as well. Then add 8 cups of water, 5 cloves of garlic, a 2 to 3 inch piece of ginger, and then whatever other vegetables you have around, broccoli, bok choy, napa, any of those vegetables you can add into there, and you can add more water if you'd like. And then just boil that up for a while. Take a pound of tofu. You can either use soft tofu or firm tofu, and cut that into small little cubes. If you eat fish, a nice thing to do to give the soup a little bit more dimension, as Anita was talking about, sometimes, you know, just adding other levels of flavor, you can put in some bonito flakes, which is, they are fish flakes, and I put them into a tea ball and put them into the pot of water while I'm boiling it, and that just gives it a little extra flavor. But you certainly can just leave that out if you do not eat fish. And then after the soup all comes together and all the vegetables are soft, you're going to take out some of the broth into a separate little bowl and mix it with 6 tablespoons of miso, and you can use a combination of white miso and red miso, or the lighter miso is sweeter, the darker miso is a little bit more intense. So whichever you like or whichever you have in the house will work. And that's it. Okay? I also boil up some soba noodles on the side and add some noodles to the dish. And that is it. And it's great. You can save it, put it in the refrigerator. But if you put the miso in it, you don't want to bring the soup to a boil, okay, because that takes away some of the nutritional value of the miso. So anyway, everyone, I hear my music playing. I'm getting kicked off the air. So everyone have a great rest of the day, and I will see you next week. Bye.